Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, welcome everybody. I'm going to invite us to begin our class this evening. This is our second Monday during the season of Lent, and we're spending Lent talking about death and dying, which seems really appropriate. We will talk about resurrection later on, but not tonight. You've got a few more weeks of this. I gave you an assignment last week, and then we nailed down exactly which date our guest speaker was going to be with us. And so if you did not get your homework done, you get a reprieve. The homework was to write a rough draft of your own obituary. And so to think about some of the things that are important to you, such that you might want to have them in your obituary. I also will offer to you, I got an email from Perry Van Tassel this morning that said, hey, if you have the March and April Daily Word devotional booklet, the articles before each month's affirmations are also about dying. And Perry says they're mostly done well. So Bev has hers right there.
All right.
So another opportunity to meditate on what it means that we are all creatures who will die at some point. I want to introduce to us a guest with us this evening. Ruby is a chaplain with Unity Point at Home Hospice. Ruby's worked the last 8 years as a chaplain and for the past 3 years also as a bereavement counselor. Ruby's ordained in the United Methodist Church and serves patients and families from all faith backgrounds and no faith background. And we asked, what do hospice patients find important at the end of their lives? And as a chaplain, we'll hear some extra insight into the things that are kind of actually heavy on folks' minds when they are nearing the end of life. So I will hand it over to Ruby.
Thank you very much. And I'm happy to be a part of this group tonight. You are a wonderful group of people. I really enjoyed your banter with one another. So I hope that can continue with our conversation this evening as well. Death and dying, yes, can be a very heavy topic. However, it's also a very joyful topic as well and can be uplifting too. So hopefully we find a bit of a mix with that this evening. So as a chaplain, specifically in my role with Unity Point Hospice, when I meet patients for the first time, a lot of them, what's on their mind is just their family and their loved ones. And wanting to spend more time with them. And family can be a variety of things. As we know, it can be, you know, blood relation, but also it can be neighbors, it can be friends, the church family, coworkers, you know, whatever family looks like, you know, it's a lot of different things for people. And then there are those that are, I would say, have isolated themselves from those around them. And that's by choice. That's not because of one thing or another. That's just who they are. And that's okay too. And so when we come into the picture, sometimes we can be a little bit intruding as hospice staff into their space. But for the most part, they're pretty welcoming because they know we're there to help them. Most of the time people are, thinking about their family, their loved ones, and wanting them to visit. I also work out of the Taylor House, the hospice house. And so right are limited due to the pandemic. And I have really found with a lot of our patients, they really do limit it just to the family to come in and to see them just because they want to spend all that time with their family. And they usually talk with their friends or whomever over the phone. So, And I know, let's see, Laura, what was another She said another question that you might have had was, what is it if they could have done earlier in life prior to leading up to hospice? Everyone's hospice journey is different. So sometimes it's something that is expected and they knew this was going to be the chain of events that hospice would be involved at some point in their life. And there's another group of people that it's very unexpected. They had no idea. It caught them off, you know, left guard, so to speak, or whatever. So for those who it's very, they're expecting it, they're very prepared in the sense that, you know, they've had these conversations with their family as far as what they want when they die. For example, like being in their home, or maybe they don't want to be at home. They want to be like at a hospice house, or, you know, just different things. They also talk about if there are any rituals and things too. Different religions have different practices for end of life too. So they've discussed that as well. Those that it's been caught off guard, it's a little bit more difficult. Some of those conversations, and that can be hard for the family, especially if it's cancer and it's like stage four and it's metastasized throughout the body. You know, those are some heartfelt conversations that, you know, the family really, they've never really discussed at all. And so there's a lot of tears and just a lot of angst and just a lot of emotions. But I guess, what kind of things are you thinking about? And wanting to know more about as far as death and dying and how hospice plays a part or doesn't play a part. And yeah.
Ruby, I would like to have a little more insight on how you decide, how they decide when a patient is ready for hospice, and secondly, what's the average stay, the length of time that a person is in hospice?
So our Dr. Lockemeyer, she will speak, I think, more to this next week as well, but in order for someone to get into hospice care, they have to be given a diagnosis of life. And so the doctor comes in and says hospice is appropriate for them, and then goes and asks them if they want to have home hospice or going to the Taylor house. And so that's kind of initially how it starts, is usually from the doctor. Sometimes we do actually have the family call in and say, you know, mom or dad or whomever is not doing good. We want hospice involved because they've had a good hospice experience with other family members. And then we tell the family they need to talk to their primary caregiver or care physician to see if they would be appropriate for hospice. And so the doctor looks at them and says, okay, I see that, yes, you're appropriate. And then our admission nurse gets involved and she comes out and explains hospice and what that looks like. And then they get signed up. And then as far as, I don't know those numbers. And I know it's different with home hospice versus like our Taylor house, hospice house. Cause I think at the Taylor house, it might be a couple of days average. But I'm not sure what it is for home hospice. It could be a matter of several weeks to a month. I'm really not sure, because we do have a lot of people that come in and we only have them for hours. But then we also have people who we have in hospice that are a year too. So, I mean, it really is drastic. So yeah, so it really starts with the doctor. Typically.
Lost my wife. She suffered from cancer for long time, but the last 2 years, I just watched her go downhill, going downhill. And I was taking care of the pills and everything. Then I was dropping morphine in her mouth when she couldn't swallow pills anymore. I called hospice, and within 4 hours, they brought all the beds and equipment and everything that you can imagine into my house, and it just lifted the weight of the world off my shoulders. It was the best thing that ever happened to me.
I'm glad you had a very good experience for hospice.
My husband was in the hospice, Mercy Hospice at Johnston. And after he passed away, I went through some grief classes at the hospice. There were about a dozen of us. We all happened to be women. And one woman shared with us four things that you should say when someone is dying. And I wish someone had told me that ahead of time, because at that last moment, it's odd because he'd been sick for 2 years and I didn't know what to say at that moment other than I love you.
What was interesting is talking about grief is I realized what was going down and is eventually going to happen. And when it finally happened again, it was like, oh, it's over. And I figured out that I had grieved for 2 years, watching her die. So afterwards, you get busy as crazy and doing all the things you need to do. And it was like, geez, I'm still alive. I'm still alive. I need to go on, be strong. And I realized that I had done much of my grief towards the end.
That's not uncommon, especially if they've had a long illness, to have done some of your grief processing before the passing. That doesn't mean that you'll completely stop grieving after their loss and death, but it sometimes just means that you've processed the majority of it. I do find that people who come to an acceptance prior to the passing of their loved, their grief journey is more, I would say, peaceful. Because I do work with those who've lost their loved ones at the Taylor House. And I've been working with a woman recently who her husband's passing was very unexpected. And there was a lot of anger with his and just disbelief. And so helping her to process and get to a point of acceptance. She's not there yet. It's only been just a month. So it'll still take some time before she can get there. But yeah, there's just a lot of hurt that she carries, a lot of breath away moments throughout the day. So.
We had a conversation last week about Warren, who is just below you on my screen, planning to have, obviously after this would not be a super spreader event, but planning to have just a big Warren party that we're gonna have prior to his death. So he's gotta live until everybody's vaccinated. We have no reason to think that he won't. But we were talking about, you know, some of the conversations that, you know, that we as healthy people can have to kind of what set our loved ones up for a better grieving process when it comes time to, you know, hopefully we have some time to have, you know, those final conversations as well. But what are things that people often sound like, boy, I really wish we had talked about this, or I wish I had said these things earlier?
Obviously every family is different. because I've worked with some families where it's mom or dad who is in our hospice, and they shared with me how they have tried to have like the funeral conversation with their kids, but they refuse to have that conversation. They adamantly refuse. And so some things you cannot force on people. I mean, you just can't, just because they're not willing to go there, and that's okay. But it is very helpful though, to the majority of people that I talk with, who have talked about the funeral and have talked about their wishes and what they want. Because a lot of times at the time of death, there's so many things just swirling besides grief in your head. And so making those decisions is a lot easier when you already know what your loved one wanted. So especially having it written down on paper, that's the best and the greatest gift that you can give for your family. And then if they're willing to talk about it, great. If they're not, at least telling them where to find the information, or I'm not sure if funeral homes, you know, would keep that file on record for the funeral home to keep for you. I'm not sure, but definitely having easy access for the family when the time comes. But also take those trips, like do those things that you always talk about doing. Don't wait, just do them. I know I've worked with a lot of individuals who said they wanted to wait till they retired before they took whatever trips. And then when they retired, they found out they had cancer, and then it was stage 3 and stage 4, and it just progressed. And so they never got those trips or never got to do those things. So I say, don't wait. Just do, just go do that. And it doesn't have to be anything big or elaborate either. I mean, just whatever it is, that however you want to spend time with family, with fishing or going to, you know, I don't know, walks or whatever. It doesn't have to be big, but just doing things together as much as you can, because you don't know. Yeah.
Maybe that fits in with what Warren was saying about planning a big party. My thought is, why do you have to start at a particular point? Now, maybe this is, I don't know whether it's off topic or not, but I would think that if I were to go out and start tomorrow to have a great party for the rest of my life, even though I'm not sick, that wouldn't be so bad.
Warren will bring his accordion.
So, when Ruby mentioned the question about funeral home arrangements and can the funeral home keep some arrangements on file for you, we will have a funeral director with us in 2 weeks. So we will have a chance to get some straight scoop on that as well. And some of the options that are available in funeral planning, but also especially those pre-arrangements. But yes, I think John's perpetual party with Warren accompanying on accordion, I think sounds just marvelous.
Careful, you might hurt Bruce's feelings if you don't invite him in his kazoo.
Well, I'll send you each the playlist.
Good job, John.
Well, Warren's party, are we supposed to tell you all the nice things about you that we would say at your funeral?
Ruby, you can see how anything goes on these contemporary issues class. I got to defend myself. John, I wasn't planning on doing it every day indefinitely. I was planning on mainly one evening, a party of one day, maybe. Not just, Claudia probably would not allow me to do it more than one night.
Depending on what you continue a party, could consider a party. I was talking about just the opposite, Warren.
Well, John, you've got a unique way of traveling, as do I. But just to give Ruby benefit of the doubt here, last week I mentioned that my wife had two very close friends call and talk with her. Basically, this is our last conversation because I'm near death. Now, they were both mentally rational enough. So I've got a question to Anne and Bruce if they would share with me. During the last week before the death occurred, were you able to have two-way conversations with your spouses, or by that time had it become more of them listening and you doing the talking? Because I would love to think I could have some meaningful conversations with Claudia in the last week of my life, but I was so impressed that these two women called my wife while they were able to have that last call, if you will. And I've just never encountered that. So that's why I thought I needed to move this celebration of life while I'm still living. And as far as Anne, you can say anything you want. I would not have any objection. I can handle the truth. I have had years of practice being told things that were kind of new to me. But I'm wandering here. But anyway, back to Anne and Bruce. Were you able to have two-way conversations right up to the last week or near the time of death?
No, it was about 2 to 3 weeks that I pretty much lost her.
Okay.
It was one way.
My husband didn't want to talk about any plans. I think he was in denial up until the last few days. Uh-huh. Even we were going to go to there was a new trial in Iowa City. He'd been in a trial at Mayo, and it was unsuccessful. And then they opened up one in Iowa City, and he was still wanting to do that until the doctor just said, you know, it's too late. So,
I can't remember the author, but there's a wonderful poem, and I should have done my homework and looked it up, and I will. But the reoccurring phrase, and tell them now, you know, that you don't keep these things inside, that you share them with people, and you don't even need to be near death. You know, we carry around things in our head that we need to express verbally to our friends and family. And that's the thing that, believe it or not, I think I picked that up in 1967 when I was an office manager at Calvin Manor here in Des Moines. One of the residents shared it with me, and I'm sure I can lay my hands on it. But anyway, I'll do my homework. But it was just, you know, so many people, I shouldn't say that. I have sensed that there's a lot of people at funerals that had regretted not saying some things earlier on. I just know there's a lot of that. That people, for whatever reason, and I don't want to be, you know, every time I see somebody going into deep praise about it, their friendship was valuable to me or how I enjoyed things we did, but at least get it said once, if not twice, you know, when the opportunity presents itself. So then when you are unable to do it, you'll remember, well, I've talked with Bruce, or I've talked with Ann, or I've talked with Russ and Mary. You know, I'm not saying, gosh, I didn't get that done.
Warren, my mother was dying of pancreatic cancer at age 98, and she lived in Florida. I was able to call and talk to her on the phone every day up till the day before she died.
Uh-huh. Well, good for
and
you.
She was very,
yeah, she very was sharp enough that oh, you had oh, yeah. a true conversation.
Oh, definitely, yeah,
wonderful.
She could probably remember what I told her the day before, yeah. too.
Yeah, well, I also know that I put into my all these legal papers, I want plenty of painkiller. You know, I don't want to bite the bullet and put up with pain, so I could happen to be in a medically induced la-la land because of my request to not have to experience pain. So I think I've got to remember that.
Does booze count?
And I was,
count?
Yeah, Bruce counts as pain, so Warren does not want to have to endure you either.
Does booze count?
Oh, I heard does Bruce count?
It's a good one.
Oh, man.
Ruby, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what you counsel family members to do sort of during that time when Warren is in his medically induced coma prior, so when we can't have the two-way conversations anymore.
So when our loved ones get to a point where they become, unconscious and unable to respond, at least verbally. Sometimes families say that, they squeezed my hand or they kind of did a little smile and stuff. And some of those are intentional by our loved one, but some of them are just reflexes. However, it has been proven that hearing is the last thing to go. They've done medical studies and testing with the brain waves, and they found that people who they know, so like, their spouse or their children, grandchildren, if they would come into the room and start talking with them, they see the brainwave activity and they recognize the voice. And I would imagine that would be for close friendships and other people that are close in their lives. So I always tell family members to keep talking to your loved one. Don't feel like you have to stop, even though they're not responding. Tell them how much you love them. Reminisce of fun times together. And when there's other family and friends around in the room too, it's okay to laugh and to joke about those, times gone by, and to remember, because they will participate in their own way and they will enjoy the laughter and just the joy that is filling up the room. I also recommend if they have like favorite TV show, a lot of our older clientele enjoy The Price is Right. So I'm like, well, turn on The Price is Right. Let them, listen to that because it's something familiar, or put in that, that CD that they love to play at home or something, or whatever radio station, have that in the background, but very low. It doesn't need to be very high because they'll be able to hear it. So be careful too what you say, because they do hear. So if there's any secrets that you kept from mom all these years and you still don't want mom to know, then don't talk about those secrets while mom is laying in bed and unresponsive, because she will hear it. And she might have a talking with you one day in heaven. So,
The last day of my...
Oh, go ahead.
The last day when my husband was unresponsive, he had a lot of visitors and we got kind of noisy. And the nurse came and told my sister. She didn't tell me. I wasn't aware of it till later. But she said, sometimes a lot of noise bothers the patient and we should have been more quiet. So.
And that depends, because I would say some of our patients really love that because their families are boisterous and loud. And I mean, that's just how it is. So for your husband, if that was something that he was used to anyways, Anne, then it probably was comforting for him. So the nurse was just, she was coming from her own point of view of what maybe she felt. But we don't like to impose our own thoughts on our patients and families, because if they're a family, then obviously it's going to be quiet in the room, but if they're boisterous and laughing and having fun, then absolutely. So that's the way it should continue to be.
And I think he would have enjoyed knowing all those people came to see him. And they even told us that we could bring a pet as long as we had proof of shots. So I contacted our vet and she sent the paperwork that showed our shots were up to date. And I brought one of our cats to visit him, and he was unaware. I put the cat on his lap and I took his hand and petted the cat, but he was not responsive at that time.
But that was important for your cat though.
Yeah.
Cause cause a lot of animals, they, after the passing will wander around in the house. Like if they passed away, like at a hospice house or whatever, or in the hospital, they just wander. And so we do recommend to bring article clothing or something that, they had last worn So that way the animal can smell it and just kind of know that they're no longer with us.
Mm-hmm. My younger daughter, Kathleen, about 10 years ago when my mother died, was able to be with her the last couple of days of her life. Amanda, the older one, had to get back to work, and my mother lingered for a while. Kathleen swears that when she was talking to my mother, even though she was, I'll use the word unresponsive, that she did show signs of understanding and hearing, but I didn't see that in anybody else in the room when people came. But I'm hoping you're right, and I'm hoping she was right.
No matter what, that brought comfort to her, and that's what was important.
Exactly. That's the point I didn't make. I'm sorry.
When my father was dying, he was 95. My mom went in and told him he didn't have cancer, but he was just wearing out. And my mom went in there and told him it was okay for him to go, you know, so he would be at peace with that.
About 25 years ago, we had a couple at Covenant. He was a funeral director, Steve Reck, and his wife, Wendy, was his church secretary. And they always invited the teens, the youth of the church, out to the funeral home to give a little lecture on death and dying. And they showed the process, and they showed them the crematorium and all that stuff. And wow, the kids, I think, gained a heck of a lot at a young age. So
that's a great idea.
We ought to continue. We ought to get that going again.
That was very good for the kids, especially our boys.
Yeah.
When well, and how about you as adults? Did you two learn, or I mean, did all of you that may have been involved, Did it help you at all?
I didn't. Mary went once. No, they needed drivers.
Yeah,
and
I went once.
And Mary was a driver once.
Yeah.
When Scott died, that same funeral director was the person who handled it. And I think it was helpful that. He knew Scott fairly well.
I think that would be helpful for the family, because if the funeral director is familiar with a person, they kind of know the facial smiles or the features, and it's a little easier for them to do some arranging physically on the body. Is that true too, Ruby? Do you know if it helps to know, or do you know any of that specific preparation for the
funeral? No, I don't know if I mean, I know that they ask for photos and stuff, but I don't know if that's why they want the photos or not, or if they just kind of, yeah, I'm not sure. That would be a good question for the funeral director.
Yeah, hang on to that for a couple of weeks, see if that comes back to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Remember that.
I can give an example of Steve knowing Scott. When I looked at the death certificate, I noticed that it said he died on July the 3rd. And down at the bottom, cause of death, it said injury sustained in an accident on July the 4th. Mm. And so I asked Steve, I said, that's kind of weird. Do I need to get that corrected? And Steve said, no, don't bother. I said, it's only insurance companies that are that much interested in death certificates. And besides, Scott would prefer you left it that way.
Went out with a bang.
Bit of a dumpster. So
I would also comment that Terry was losing his taste, and he, not very many things tasted good to him, but he really liked tacos from Carlos O'Kelly's. And Pam, who's on the screen tonight, brought him tacos from Carlos O'Kelly's, and that he would eat.
Wow, that's nice.
That's great.
Ruby, tell me how you selected this particular
calling,
vocation or branch of or calling, Marilyn said, and what satisfies you about it, because I've known two people fairly well who were well, in both cases officially hospital chaplains, but both crossed over into your bailiwick sometimes, but I never really understood why they thought that was their calling.
I can give you a couple of things. I grew up in a small town, Northwest Iowa, and one of the town cemeteries was my backyard. And so I grew up playing around headstones. That's how I did the big complicated math, was learning to subtract with those. But I was so very comfortable around death and dying, and seeing people coming to the grave, graveyard and things, and seeing the tent go up and watching them dig. And I mean, you know, I was a curious kid, so I was kind of interactive with them. But then as I got older, when I had my year residency at the VA hospital in Atlanta, I was a chaplain there for a year, and there was a woman whose husband died on the table. The Atlanta VA hospital was not an emergency hospital, and so this was the very first death that this doctor had ever experienced, and he was in his late 50s. And so he was very traumatized by this death, because it was his very first. And so they called the chaplain, me to come, so to be present when the doctor tells this wife. And so I was led into a room, and she was sitting at the table with a couple of her family members as well. And then the doctor comes in, and you could tell he's really distressed, and his nurse is with him too. And so he proceeds then to tell this wife and the family what has happened. And then he quickly leaves the room with the nurse. And I could tell the nurse was comforting him, because I'm pretty sure he was gonna go outside and just bawl in the hallway. And so so I'm left in the room with the wife and the family. And the wife, she just starts to wail. She's just wailing to high pitches, and it's just very emotional for her. And what took me by surprise actually was that all of these other family members that were with her, all of them started leaving the room like one by one. So one left, and then another, and then it was just her and I. And so I got up and sat next to her and just sat there as she continued to wail and held her hand, and, you know, held her shoulder some, and just was there with her. And until she was able to compose herself, calm down, and then herself get up and go out of the room. And so I guess with that experience, I really felt actually at home in the midst of that distress and that trauma. I wasn't afraid to be there and to sit with this woman and with her intensities. And so, and that's what I do often with hospice, is I sit with people with their anger or their sadness or whatever they, or joy, I mean, that too, whatever emotions, and just journey alongside them. And I always feel like no one should be left alone to feel those emotions and to be experiencing that much pain or heartache by themselves. I feel like someone should be with them. And so I want to be there. So that's why I've been doing it for 8 years. So, yeah.
Takes a lot of strength to do something like that. Wow.
You know, I've been to visit people in hospice who were older and didn't have, you know, relatives left. And, you know, found that good for both of us. But then when Anne's husband was dying, I've never known, you know, you don't want to be interfering. And so I get this message from her that goes, Terry wants visitors. And I really hadn't talked to Terry that much, you know, by myself, you know. So, you know, I went over there and I thought, oh, what am I going to say? And but my gosh, he just talked and talked and talked and talked. And I was just amazed, you know, it was a good experience. So you never know, you know, what you're going to run into. And I was so glad that I, you know, did that. So I was able to go a few times. And
you are very good at that, Pam.
But you don't want to be interfering, you know, especially if they've got family on it. It's hard to know what to do.
Pam leads me to a question for you, Ruby. And it comes from, again, my mother. She's the only person I've had in my life with whom I've been involved at her death. So she's the only one I talk about. She, through her life, particularly her later years, when she was perfectly well and with it, she would say, oh, don't bother. Don't make everybody else, you know, upset if I'm sick or something. And then she would go to the point of saying, and when I'm gone, just throw me in a ditch. And I was pretty sure she was kidding. But then I told the story in this group last week or the week before that she had talked about making arrangements and she never seemed to get around to it. So when she did die in hospice, rather suddenly, it took her 3 days, but she just didn't wake up one morning, but it took her 3 days. And we were trying to think, okay, what about the funeral? What are we going to do? And when she did die, the head nurse or whatever came in and said, okay, we've got the funeral home coming. And I said, which one? Oh, and she, Major Erickson, if you know Mason City. And I said, why'd you call them? She said, oh, she made that all very clear to us. She has her casket picked out and everything. She never told us. She never told me, even though she'd complained about not having arrangements. And that leads me back to the question, how much, when somebody says, don't fuss and bother about me and so forth, do you have any hint on how to determine whether they believe themselves, let alone whether you should believe them? I mean, that's a biggie, but I thought I'd ask.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, I did have a patient who said when he passes, take him over, I think it was to Burger King. He said, take him and have him fry him up and, you know, then his family can have his ashes or something. That's not what happened. He was a veteran. And so I think they worked with the veterans cemetery. And so anyways, but yeah, no. Normally, to be honest, most of the time people don't have anything arranged at all for funerals. Mm. So I'm actually pleasantly surprised when people do. And I always tell them and I affirm them, that is the greatest gift you have given your family. Well done. Because it is the most amazing gift you can give your family to have those finished. But yeah, most of the people though don't. So if they're kind of laissez-faire about it, I assume then, yeah, they haven't done anything because most people don't, so.
Interesting.
So John, did you put her in a ditch?
No. We scratched our heads, but since she'd already paid for a plot, we decided to use that.
That's nice. You didn't waste that hole.
Although, good. A little more seriously, her whole life was self-effacing to a psychologically disturbing point at some times. Oh. But she was always convinced that she didn't matter, that everybody else came first. And a lot of the time she thought that was true. Sometimes she didn't, and you did navigating between those two positions in a half hour conversation got tricky sometimes. In other words, if I've ever said, okay, yeah, we've got a ditch picked out, I don't know what she would have done.
Bruce, I got a question for Bruce. Bruce, are you there?
No.
Here's the question then. When you have your funeral, can you get a 3, 7, 10, or 21 gun salute? Oh. How many can you have?
The Iowa Guard does 21 guns. Actually, it's 21 shots. They have 7 rifles that they shoot 3 times.
Okay. Is that pretty standard for all military?
Yeah, I've not seen 21 guys lined up together for one shot.
7 or guys with 3 shots apiece. Okay. 21. Just curious.
That's a good question, Bob.
I've seen the bugles.
Oh.
And they don't have very many good bugle players, so they have a little sound device inside the horn.
Oh yeah.
Play the most beautiful taps ever.
I heard that.
It's perfect. There's a little microphone in there, and it's incredible.
Mm.
They don't need to push the keys, but they do.
No, there's no keys on a bugle.
A bugle? No. It's not a trumpet?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think if there's 10 guns involved, that's a firing squad.
Yeah, ma'am, that's a cornet.
A cornet.
I'd like to have a tuba. You know.
I guess I'm ornery enough that being Scottish myself, I might go for a piper.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I know bagpipes have a limited number of notes that they can play. So they can only play in certain keys. I don't know if they can pull off taps.
No, I wasn't having them do taps, do something. I hadn't even thought about that. Do something traditional like Scotland the Brave or something. Something suitable to wake the rest of the dead.
So they know you're there.
Yep.
Well, I was a drummer, so maybe I get some drum and bugle corps.
Oh,
hey. Yeah.
So you'd be gone. You can't beat it.
Oh.
So, Ruby, we are working very hard as this group to become really super comfortable with death and on laughing terms with it. I have been wondering, though, as we've been talking, and it came to mind actually when you were talking about kind of what's the referral process. I know that we've all interacted with folks who were just not ready to recognize the fact that they were going to be dying, and at the same time, you know, dealing with maybe, you know, the cousins who fly in from Virginia or wherever, and they're pretty sure that so-and-so is not dying. Put a question mark at the end of that.
If a doctor comes in and says that hospice is appropriate and there's pushback on the patient and family, the doctor might go a different direction and say, well, maybe palliative care or something could get involved. In a lot of those cases, though, the family will tell us, oh, I wish we would have had hospice sooner. We do get that quite often. I hear that more at the Taylor House than I do at like home hospice patients. But yeah, it is tricky though, with other family flying into town, you know, that daughter or son from the East or the West Coast, you know, they come in and they leave or whatever, and they've disheveled things and caused a ruckus as far as like, well, yeah, they're not dying, they're fine, you know, and the family who is there 24/7 is like, oh no, wait a minute, that's, you know, they are, you know, you're not here every day, you know, so there can be that tension and that struggle. And so it ultimately comes down to you as the patient making that choice and that decision. If, you know, if you want that involved and you want to have those people coming to help support you and make sure this is a comfortable journey for you, great. If not, that's okay too. That is your decision. So it's, you know, we always take the lead from the patient and what they want. We don't want to push them into anything that they don't want. If you're not ready, you're not ready. And I mean, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with being in denial. I actually do have patients in hospice who are in denial, but the family all is accepting and knowing that they're going to die, but the patient themselves, they're like, no, I'm not going to die. And so I help the family and let them know it's okay. That's where they're at. Maybe they'll get to the point of acceptance when they become unresponsive. Maybe that's the time in which, because I truly believe that God is with everyone at the end and having some sort of dialogue. I don't know what that is. Because I consistently feel God's presence at the end of somebody's life. So when I enter in a patient room at the Taylor House and that patient is unresponsive, I feel God there. Not that I didn't before, earlier on, but the presence is just very palpable. It's almost as if the veil between our lives here and beyond, it's lifted and God just engulfs. It's just amazing for me. I know not everyone can feel that or experience that, but it's amazing. And so I share that with families and say, you know, it's very possible that's the time and when they will accept the fact that they're dying and go with God. So.
Ruby, I just listened very intently to what you said, and I watched Nathan nodding along in what I'll call agreement. I'll ask you two, as trained pastors, is that scripture or is that just something in you? Feeling that God is there at the end, clear
that
to the
sense
end,
of God's
with
presence
everyone.
At the end.
Yeah.
It's at least experience. And I mean, Ruby's the Methodist here, so she can talk about experience. I have to ground things in scripture. you know, I mean, there are plenty of places in scripture where, you know, places, you know, easy to find places like Psalm 139, where, you know, there's nowhere I can go that God is not. I think the thing that in my experience makes it more obvious at the end of life is the, you don't have other stuff to hide behind. You know, you can no longer pretend that this isn't happening. And, you know, when that kind of truth is either being told or being enacted, then we start to recognize something about who God actually is.
When my mother, the only experience I've ever had was my mother when she was 98 and her last time she went to the hospital, I've told Ann and Pam this, but she asked my brother, I was at work and he was there during the day, and she asked him, am I going to die? And she said, well, he said he didn't want to deal with that at all. I mean, that's not my brother. So he said, well, of course not. You have to live to be 100 because you need a birthday card from the president. And this was in 06. And she said, well, you know, I didn't vote for him.
A good sense of humor besides.
she talked right. I mean, I knew about her history and her as a child. And so she didn't remember much of anything. She really never, you know, her last few years, she really didn't remember anything, but you could take her clear back to her childhood. So we talked about her sledding on the hill across the way from where the family farm was. And as a child, and sledding and with her brothers and sisters, and she talked about that, even though she was supposed to be on oxygen, she would talk about that. And I left the hospital at 11, and at 3 o'clock I got a call that she had gone. But the hospital had someone come in to sit with her for those hours. They knew she was going to die, but they never said anything to me. I could have sat those next 3 or 4 hours, but I didn't. I figured she would be there in the morning. The hospital personnel did not say anything to me that would make me think that she was going to die that night, but they seemed to know, because otherwise why would they have someone come in her room and sit there?
Does everyone go through modeling at the end of life, which is do you want to explain what that is, Ruby?
So it's a discoloration. It starts with the feet. So if you ever notice, the nurses will check the patient's feet during visits as things have declined. It's because they're looking for that discoloration. It's kind of bluish grayish. And it typically, starts with the feet and kind of goes up from there, or and also in the hands. Dr. Lockemeyer, I know, can speak more to that next week as well. But yes, normally it does. Sometimes it doesn't, though. But under normal circumstances, yes.
Thank you. Okay.
So the nurse came in. I sat with my husband all night. I hardly slept at all in a chair beside his bed. And at 7 in the morning, the nurse came in and said, "I think this is it. I think he's leaving." And she hadn't come in all night. I don't know how she knew at 7 in the morning it was time, but it was time. But Sue, I wanted you to share when your mother told your brother that all these people were in the room.
Oh, well, my mother, when she comes out of anesthesia, her mind just, she had had a broken shoulder or something and had it set or something. And she was my mother was the quietest lady, never said any words, hardly at all. And all of a sudden she had a big cheery voice and she was talking to people over in the corner and those over there, and "Come on in, you know, I want to talk to you. I haven't seen you for years." And there were all these imaginary people in the room. And it was, you know, it went on for quite a while. My brother's kind of sitting there going, "What?" I said, "Well, it's your turn to sit and listen to this." And finally he said to her, "Well, you know, I think it's time for these people to leave so that you can get some rest." And so she said, "Okay, bye-bye." And she said all their names and just boisterous voice. And my mother was just the softest spoken person, never said anything. And, you know, but she, during anesthesia, just brought out all this fun lady that I've never seen, you know.
So I thought maybe that was when she was at her end. But
apparently. No, actually at the end, I mean, I was talking to her at 11 o'clock at night. 4 hours later, she died. So, no, I could talk about the sledding, and she would talk about the sledding with her brothers and sisters. And that was a pleasant thought for her, you know. It was what she could remember, because she didn't remember anything else. I mean, you know, she'd be in the moment and then 2 minutes later, she didn't even remember saying something or doing something or whatever. But no, that other was just under anesthesia. She was kind of a different person, someone I'd never met. But that's kind of fun to have that memory of her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you ever have people confide things in you that they won't to the family?
Yes. Yeah.
And so then tell me some secrets.
Yeah, I was gonna say that I in turn have not shared those with anyone. So yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, like what kinds of things? Like, "I'm glad nephew Bill left, I never liked him anyway, that kind of thing?
Some pretty intense emotional scarring, physical scarring, abandonment, and just different, yeah. Yeah, mostly emotional. So, mm-hmm.
Okay, interesting.
Mm-hmm. That they received or that they did to others. Mm-hmm. So,
interesting.
How about
confession? Thank you, John. Sorry to interrupt in that. Just to send a kind of some like of a closure, cleansing, a confession type thing. Are you thinking, Ruby? And
that'd be a good assignment for next week. For everybody.
Yeah, write your confession.
If they're of the Catholic tradition, that's when I pull the priest in and get the priest involved. And I work with there's some priests in the area that I can call on if they don't have a priest that they work with. And then, I guess in some respects it's maybe confession, or it's just a lot of it is just getting things off their chest that they've not been able to talk about for maybe at all, or they haven't shared in years, and they just need to release it to somebody. And so yeah. I'm there to release it too.
You're the warm body that gets that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
I have wondered how I would cope with it if I had killed anyone in war. I wasn't in the service, so I haven't had much chance to talk to people, but many people have, maybe somebody on the screen, I don't know. But do you get people coming clean with themselves or God or something toward the last about wartime experiences, when typically they won't have talked to anybody about them their whole lives?
I actually got that more at the Atlanta VA when I worked there. I worked with a PTSD group from Vietnam era, working with some of those gentlemen. I've gotten a few here in Iowa, veterans, but not very many. So
is it your impression that people find a way to deal with that before the last, with themselves at least? Maybe not. I'm just asking.
Yeah, I suppose. They've dealt with it in ways that maybe were not the best, maybe not the healthiest ways, I suppose. So then in telling me, they were actually being honest and open about it for the first time, where before they were just hiding it with whatever, alcohol for some cases, some of them just workaholics or whatever. So, mm-hmm.
Nathan, did they tell you anything about that in training, classes, whatever?
Not in particular. I know that there's some new work being done, and I can't remember if any of it has been written at length. But if you look up moral injury, a Presbyterian, Rita Nakashima Brock, has done some work and I believe some writing on that. If that's of interest to you to dig more into, and working specifically with wartime veterans. So I want to honor folks' time and honor Ruby's time as well, with gratitude for this time that we've gotten to spend together.
Thank you,
Ruby.
Thank you so much, Ruby.
Ruby, any final words, things that you wish we had prompted you to say, that now's the time?
Oh, don't make them final. No.
Final word.
it is always... not in every situation, but at the very end with your loved one, it's always good to know that if you are present and they pass away, it's because they wanted you there. If nobody is in the room and they pass away, it's because that's what they wanted. I do believe that they make a conscious choice to pass away when people are in or out of the room. We've had individuals at the Taylor House ask for a particular son. The son lived in California. And once he came to the threshold of the doorway and said, "Mom," she took her last breath. That's what she needed to hear before she passed. So I always try to tell people there should be no guilt involved if you were there or if you were not there at their passing. So.
Nice. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time this evening and for sharing your experiences and your insights with us. We are very, very grateful.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And next week, we will have the medical director of Unity Point Hospice, Dr. Rebecca Lockenmeyer, tell us about some of the medical side of the death and dying process. So we got more of the relational and spiritual side tonight, more of the medical side next week. In 2 weeks, we will have a funeral director to talk with us about planning your funeral. The funeral director is Brad Kurtz. He works with Cedar Memorial in Cedar Rapids. So he is not in a position to try to sell you anything. He's just going to tell you about what you need to know for planning your funeral.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.